Welcome to Journal Club with Happy. I'm your host, Happy Kasai, and I'm a graduate student at Vanderbilt University. This podcast is structured as a short scientific journal club where I will discuss scientific papers and relate their major findings. Generally, journal clubs have a scientific audience ranging from undergraduate science students to university professors. And the communication during these sessions is of scientific jargon that is very niche to the field of study. For this podcast, I try very hard to use everyday language to explain science. It's not going to be easy, and you'll see me fail, but hopefully it'll get better over time. I'm also a science student, so in this podcast, we learn science together. For this episode, I have picked a paper that was published 2 weeks ago in the journal Science. The title of the paper piqued my interest, and I wanted to share it with you. It comes out of Maiken Nedergaard's lab at University of Copenhagen. The first co-authors of the paper are Felix Beinlich and Antonio Sasiminas. The title of the paper is Oxygen Imaging of Hypoxic Pockets in the Mouse Cerebral Cortex. Let's dive into it, because I'm sure you'll find it exciting. As all living things, we breathe in oxygen from the atmosphere, and our lungs capture the oxygen that we breathe in and package it in our blood cells. Those blood cells travel and deliver the oxygen to all other body parts, including the brain. The brain has a very high oxygen demand. It uses around 20% of the oxygen that we breathe in when we are at rest. It continuously requires a lot of oxygen, so a lot of neuroscience questions could be asked by measuring oxygen levels in the brain. But the development of the technique required to measure oxygen in the brain has limited the progress of the research. There have been techniques to measure the level of oxygen using phosphorescence assays and electrodes that are specially designed to detect oxygen. However, the resolution of these techniques has been very, very low. What do I mean by resolution? They do not work as fast as we want them. It's also hard to target specific brain regions with these techniques, so there was a spatial limitation as well. The authors from today's paper designed a new technology that has a much higher sensitivity to very small changes of oxygen. The technique uses an enzyme substrate method, which I'll briefly describe. The researchers expressed a fluorescent-tagged enzyme in cortical astrocytes. Astrocytes are types of cells in the brain. They help the neurons function by clearing waste and providing necessary nutrients. They protect the nerve cells, so they are a very important class of brain cells. And neuroscientists are still studying their purpose and roles in the brain. I'll add a personal story here. My first experience with neuroscience research was actually working with astrocytes, so they have a very special place in my heart. In this paper, the researchers inserted a gene into astrocytes that are located in the cortex of mice. Only the astrocytes found in the top layer of the brain have this inserted gene, and the gene produces a protein called green enhanced nanolantern. The name is not important. If you're interested in the specific details of the protein, you may look it up in the paper because I'll add a PubMed link to the episode notes, but I'll describe how the protein works. The protein green enhanced nanolantern has two parts. The first part is a luciferase enzyme called NanoLuc. It is an enzyme, which means it can take one molecule as an input and convert it into another after facilitating a biochemical reaction. In this particular case, this luciferase enzyme acts on a chemical called furimazine and converts it into furimamide. And this reaction happens in the presence of oxygen. When furimazine is converted into furimamide, there's a release of energy, and that energy is in the form of light. Along with the luciferase, there's a second part to the protein, and it's a fluorescence protein called M-neon green. This fluorescent part of the protein will produce green light when light energy is released from the luciferase part of the reaction. When furimazine is converted into furimamide, light is released, and that light is amplified by the fluorescent protein M-neon green. The amplification allows us to see and image the protein reaction under a microscope. For members of the audience that have experience with imaging and molecular tools, this approach of fluorescence amplification is a Forster resonance energy transfer, or also known as FRET. But understanding the technique is not super important for the purpose of today's discussion. So I'll go ahead and give you a one-sentence summary of the approach just for recap. The cortical astrocytes of the mice contain a protein that that shines green whenever it converts furimazine to furimamide in the presence of oxygen. It is a very clever approach because if there's more oxygen, there's more chemical reaction, and if there's more chemical reaction, the protein keeps on shining green, and that can be detected by a microscope. After all, I'll remind you that we're interested in measuring the level of oxygen in the brain, and fluorescence imaging is an indirect approach to get to the primary interest, which is oxygen concentration in the brain. After setting up their experiment in such a way, the research team then validated their technique by manipulating the level of oxygen that the mice breathe in and measuring the fluorescence that is created in the brain. And the method was very successful. When the mice were given with more oxygen concentrated air, up until 40% oxygen, there's increased fluorescence in the brain. This means that the more oxygen that the mice breathe in, the more oxygen gets to their brain, and the less oxygen that the mice breathe in, the less fluorescence being imaged in the brain. Just for context, atmospheric air, that is the air around us, the air that we breathe in, has around 20% of oxygen. And the research team validated their technique in a range of oxygen levels between 10% to 40%. And as the oxygen level increased from 10% to 40%, so does the oxygen in the brain, and so does the fluorescence that they're able to image in the brain of the mice. The validation was corroborated by another technique of oxygen measurement. I introduced it earlier. The research team placed an oxygen-sensitive electrode in the cortex to check if the results from the two techniques match, and they saw a very high correlation between the oxygen levels recorded by both techniques. They further validated their technique by measuring oxygen levels in activated regions of the brain. They did this because we know that if a part of the brain is active, there will be more blood flow to the region, and the blood will carry the oxygen required for that activity. To check for this activity-dependent increase in blood flow, the research team stimulated the whiskers of the mice with air puffs and measured oxygen levels in the somatosensory cortex. Mice use their whiskers to sense their environment, and that sensory information is processed by the part of the cortex called the somatosensory cortex. The somatosensory cortex has been a topic of discussion in the previous two episodes of this journal club. So if you're interested, please check out episodes 2 and 3. As I was saying, mice use their whiskers to sense their environments, and that sensory information is processed by the part of the cortex called the somatosensory cortex. When the whiskers of the mice are stimulated, there will be an increase in neuronal activity in the somatosensory cortex, and that activity requires oxygen. And again, the proposed model was successful at recording that increase in oxygen level in the somatosensory cortex when the whiskers of the mice were stimulated. The technique just by itself is an incredible approach at measuring oxygen in the brain. But during the development and validation of the technique, the research team observed a very interesting phenomenon. Apparently, during rest, regions of the brain experienced localized and brief episodes of low oxygen conditions. The research team coined a phrase to describe these episodes of low oxygen condition. They called them hypoxic pockets. I will elaborate on this. When oxygen levels are measured in the cortex of mice who are at rest, the technique records changing oxygen levels. The mice are not moving, and they are sedated with anesthesia. One would expect the brain to have a constant level of oxygen, but the levels were actually very dynamic. And interestingly, for durations of time ranging from a few seconds to a few minutes, certain brain regions have very low levels of oxygen, and we call these regions hypoxic pockets. Hypoxic, standing for hypo or low oxygen, and pockets, standing for their spatial localization. In the 20-minute recordings that the research team was doing in the mice cortex, they counted an average of 200 hypoxic pockets that lasted for an average duration of 50 seconds. That really surprised me because 50 seconds is almost a minute. And such low levels of oxygen could alter function of neurons in the brain. In fact, the authors compared the level of oxygen during hypoxic pockets to the hypoxic threshold, which is the level of oxygen that is required to maintain consciousness. And they found that these hypoxic pockets are similar to the hypoxic threshold. This was mind-blowing to me. Just to reiterate this, the brain goes through periods of low oxygen conditions that are similar to levels needed to maintain consciousness. On top of that, these pockets also occurred repeatedly at the same site. And in this study, the authors mentioned that a hypoxic pocket forms every 7 minutes at the same place. This means that a specific region of the cortex experiences critical drops in oxygen levels for a duration of about 50 seconds, and then the levels recover for the following 6 minutes, and then the oxygen levels drop again to the hypoxic threshold. After observing this, the research team further characterized the location of these hypoxic pockets. These pockets are found closer to veins than they are to arteries. Veins are the blood vessels that carry deoxygenated blood, while arteries carry oxygenated blood. The difference between the two is that arteries take the oxygen-carrying blood to the neurons, while the veins return the blood after the oxygen has been taken up by the neurons. And the researchers found that hypoxic pockets were located close to veins than arteries, which I sort of expected because veins will have less oxygen, and we're investigating episodes of low oxygen conditions in the brain. For the rest of the study, the research team looked at factors that affect blood flow in the brain and how those factors affect hypoxic pockets. The first factor they looked at is functional hyperemia, which is the concept that I described earlier about higher brain activity being linked to increase in blood flow and oxygen supply. By increasing the level of carbon dioxide in the air that the mice are breathing, the research team observed that there was more oxygen in the brain tissue, and that reduced the number, the area, and the time duration of hypoxic pockets. It's very counterintuitive to think that an increase in carbon dioxide and inhaled air will lead to increased blood flow in the brain. But for today, just know that an increase in carbon dioxide, to an extent, leads to the dilation or the widening of blood vessels, and that leads to higher tissue oxygen levels in the brain. The second blood flow factor that the research team looked into is their use of anesthesia. Here specifically, they looked at the commonly used sedative isoflurane. Isoflurane is another factor that increases blood flow and brain oxygen levels, and the researchers found that the use of isoflurane decreased the size and occurrence of the hypoxic pockets. From these two experiments, with the first one being carbon dioxide and the second one being isoflurane, the research team found that blood flow strongly controls hypoxic pockets in the mice cortex. The last major finding of this study related movement with oxygen levels in the brain. This is my favorite finding from this study because I'm a huge fan of physical exercise, and we're always hearing about the brain benefits of exercise, and I think this study puts some good data to back those benefits. For the final experiment, two groups of mice were used. One group was stationary on a platform, while the other group was allowed to run while the oxygen levels in the brain were being recorded. And the results were amazing. The freely running group experienced fewer hypoxic pockets, and the hypoxic pockets were smaller in area and shorter in duration. I'll say that again. When compared to stationary mice, the cortex of running mice had less hypoxic pockets. The episodes were smaller in area and shorter in duration. The authors of this study point out that this decrease is not due to an overall increase in blood flow from the exercise. They ascribe this reduction in hypoxic pockets to functional hyperemia, which is the brain activity-dependent increase in blood flow. They reached to this conclusion because sensory stimulation of the mice whiskers had a similar reductive effect on hypoxic pockets. With that said, I think it's amazing to see how physical activity directly influences oxygen levels in the brain. I think this is the cutting edge of neurovascular research. There's a lot of exciting science in the fields of aging and neurodegeneration that has pointed out the importance of blood oxygen levels. There are hypotheses and predictions that implicate reduction in blood flow to cognitive decline and aging. Sedentary lifestyle and lack of stimulation have also been linked to dementia. So research like this would provide the answers for these big and demanding science questions. With that said, the technique development is also incredible because it can be used to study other neuroscience questions in other areas of the brain, like the subcortical regions, and we can study the relationship between oxygen levels, hypoxic pockets, and how they affect behavior. That was it for today. This paper made me really hopeful about the prospect of neuroscience, and I hope it had the same effect on you. As always, I'll add a PubMed link of the original article to the episode notes so that you can check it out. I'll also add a link to the lab webpage of Dr. Nedergaard so that you can see what else is happening in that lab. Until next week, ciao.